This special episode of the Secret Identity Podcast features a look back at Spider-Man's Clone Saga via a panel that I moderated at Connecticut Comic Con 2014.
Are you sure this is legal?
I don't know.
It's fun though, isn't it?
A family full of midgets is not considered kids! That's a game!
Bond. James Bond.
I am your father.
And welcome everybody to a special edition of the Secret Identity Podcast. This is Brian Henry here, and what you are about to hear is a pretty amazing panel that occurred at the Connecticut Comic Con a couple weeks ago, as I record this now in late August. This panel was a look back at Spider-Man's Clone Saga, specifically the second Clone Saga, if you will, the one that happened during the 1990s, and the one that everybody pretty much thinks of whenever you say the words Clone Saga. The panelists for this one were Danny Fingeroth, who was a longtime Marvel editor, actually had two separate stints editing the entire Spider-Man group of books for Marvel, and he also was the one who sort of pushed the Clone Saga out of the gate. Also, Todd DeZago, who was one of the writers of the Spider-Man books at that particular point in time, Sensational Spider-Man, he was very well known for, and Scott Hanna, who, of course, is a legendary inker and also did work on that particular Clone Saga for Spidey as well. Originally, the panel was going to feature Howard Mackie as well, but he couldn't make it to the show for that weekend, and actually Scott Hanna came in and jumped in at the last minute and really, I thought, helped make the panel even more awesome than it would have been with Danny and Todd alone. So, as you'll hear, we get into a lot of the fun stuff about the Clone Saga. We talk about what it was like for them to be part of that, what sort of the atmosphere was like at the time, how history sort of looks back on the Clone Saga. It was a ton of fun. Now, as we open here in a minute, you're going to hear Todd begin to tell a story about his good friend Mike Waringo, who the anniversary of his passing was the week that Connecticut Comic Con was happening. Of course, Mike Waringo was a very well-known artist who did a lot of Spider-Man work back in the day. And so as we open this panel, you'll hear him talking about Mike and paying a nice tribute to him as well. And then we sort of get into the meat and potatoes of the panel. So it was, as I mentioned, a ton of fun. I want to thank all three of the panelists for just being awesome and really open to answering questions and just sharing stories. And you're going to hear things on this recording of this panel that they haven't talked about before, and I think Danny had mentioned at the end that this was the first panel that he'd been on looking back at the Clone Saga, and so it was very special for me as a longtime Spider-Man fan to be able to be there with people who worked on a story that I have always been very clear about, I have a lot of affection for, and so it was really great to get to spend time with them talking about that, and I think the audience really enjoyed it as well. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to the recording of this panel. You'll note that the audio isn't perfect, but it certainly, I thought, was good enough that people would want to hear the panel and hear us talking about that stuff. So without further ado, here you go.
A compassionate person when it came to other artists, young artists. When Mike passed away, his brother, who's also a sweet guy, created the Mike Waringo Scholarship Fund down at Savannah College of Art and Design, SCAD. And so the scholarship has been going for years, and we just put together a Mike Waringo Tell Us Tribute sketchbook, which is really pretty by a lot of people who did some really nice memorial pieces for Mike when he passed away. So if you would like to see some really pretty pictures or just come by the table and take a look at it, I am in the artist choice area down that way. I think it's that way.
It is that way. Yep.
It's that
way. If you go out of this room and take a left,
just go that way.
Follow the ring around, you will see a great section of artists over on the left against the windows there too. And both of these gentlemen are over that way. So
we are. It's just a little bit farther.
So let's get into it. We're talking about the Clone Saga today, and I think longtime Spider-Man fans, they either love it or they hate it. It's a very sort of love or hate relationship, although I feel like in the past several years, the barometer has gone much more towards love for this series. So, Danny, you were the group editor of the Spider-Man books, all of them, at the time that this event was coming together. So maybe you could talk about the origin of this second installment of the Clone Saga, as it were.
Right, well, if the first one was back in the 70s.
Yes.
You guys all remember the 70s? Some of you do.
Yeah.
It was the 90s. Anybody remember the 90s? It was,
yeah.
And the comic book industry had gone through a boom, and the bust was starting, but nobody knew it. But we knew that sales were starting to slack. So everybody who was an editorial, whose jobs depended on the books doing well, had to come up with ideas. And this was the era of The Death of Superman and Batman's Broken Back and 100 other things. And we needed to do something big with Spider-Man. We'd done Maximum Carnage, which was a big success, and spawned, pardon the expression, the video game, and lots of other stuff. So we had one of our writers' summits. Todd, you weren't involved yet, right?
I was not in yet.
And I challenged, I did what I always do, was I brought in some of my own crappy ideas, and I said to my writers, you know, something better, we're using my ideas, so that always scared them. And Terry Cavanaugh, who was writing The Web of Spider-Man, I think initially came up with the idea and enlisted Howard Mackie to bring back the Spider-Man clone. And so they came to our meeting, our big creative meeting with all the writers and all the artists. And the thing that they were going, that they wanted to establish, was that that there was a switch back in the 70s in that story. The Spider-Man we had been reading about for the past 15 years was the clone, and that the real Spider-Man was actually on the road having adventures of his own. And so that was the origin of it. I was completely uncomfortable with it. But I had a room full of writers and artists who were really jumping. They were jumping up and down so excited that the people in the conference room next door at the hotel where we were having the conference complained that we were making too much noise. When you're an editor, that's incredible. That's what you live for, right? Is that someone complains that your creative people are making too much noise because they're so excited. So I very hesitantly, but I greenlit it. Of course, I had to get everything approved by my boss, Tom DeFalco, who was editor-in-chief, who, when I came to him with the idea, Tom said, consider for a moment, and he turned it down, and he said, that would mean Mary Jane's been intimate with a clone all these years. Except he did not use the term has been intimate with. The writer said, well, maybe Tom would come to the meeting. So Tom came to the meeting, and we all convinced him to approve it and to be one of the writers. So that was sort of the beginning, where it all started.
And you mentioned the writers were jumping up and down at the opportunity to sort of write this story. What particular aspect of it? Was it the idea of having sort of a new Spider-Man without some of the baggage? Was it that we got to write a happy ending for Peter Parker and Mary Jane, to go off with, into the sunset? Like, what particular piece was it that they were really excited about?
Well, I think that, of course, as writers, editors are comparatively speaking, supposed to be grown-ups and keep things stable. But writers always want to shake things up. Mm-hmm. And I think they like the idea. Marvel and DC, it was always criticized for doing big, daring stories and then going, reneging on them. This change will be, we're killing Superman. Oh, maybe not, So I think as creative people and as longtime fans, I think they just wanted to say, look, we're doing this crazy, daring thing, and it's going to be for keeps and for real, And I think that's what excited them about. And I think they also like the idea that if the real Spider-Man had been in exile thinking he was the clone, there were endless stories we could tell of what he had done while he was in exile, and we started to do some of those. I think that was part of it.
And I think for me, as someone who has sort of on and off collected comics over the years, this was a time where I was actually getting back into collecting comics. And so the idea of a new Spider-Man coming in appealed to me in terms of accessibility. I mean, of course, I knew Peter Parker. I grew up with Peter Parker. But the idea that you could come into the comic at this time and have a new character to sort of latch onto, because in my mind, I would never be able to collect all the Spider-Man issues. But this was a new one I could start with. I was kind of excited about that as a reader.
And obviously you didn't know what the ending would be.
Right, exactly.
I just want to make one more sweeping statement, then I want to let Todd talk because I feel like...
I don't want to talk. Keep going.
As comic book creators, comic book editors, our job is to piss off our readers just enough that they keep coming back every month to see how we're screwing up. We need to get you to the... Because what's happening with all comics is if you think, oh, it's good old Spidey and he's fighting Doc Ock this month and he's going to have a heart attack and I don't have to bother buying it, you're not going to buy it. Right? So we have to shake things up enough to keep you just on the edge of killing us, basically. You know, on the edge of buying tickets to New York, coming and, like, killing people in the New York. I'm joking, just joking. you guys live in New York. You don't even need to buy a ticket to it. something like the Clone Saga. Ladies and gentlemen.
The legendary Scott Hanna has also joined us here. So, all right, we've got the trifecta.
So the clone thing was part of that, and it did reverse, declining sales. People were going crazy and buying lots of copies.
Yeah. And that also became somewhat of an issue in terms of the length of the event. And Scott, we were just talking about like what the appeal was both to the writers and the creators who were jumping on this premise when it first started, but also as readers. I was kind of just getting into collecting comics at the time of the 90s Clone Saga, and the idea of having a new Spider-Man that I could almost start over with was very appealing to me as a reader. So it seemed like initially like everybody was gung-ho for what this event was going to be.
Yeah, one of the things, especially as an artist, when I was first...
If not, you can share.
Oh, you got it.
There you go.
Perfect. As an artist, if you're growing up with characters, you see the same thing over and over again, and this was before we had graphic novels where we were doing like complete stories, so we started doing these really more complex, longer stories by crossing over between all the titles, and coming in with we got to design new costumes, you know, we had the Scarlet Spider version, we had the new outfit. And which actually I just drew again on the Scarlet Spider cover now.
Right.
I saw an image of Stunner, that character. I just saw it on a website the other day, and somebody blogged that somehow a rumor started that like Marvel's next superhero is going to be a female, and like of the five names, Stunner was one of them.
Very cool. Yeah.
But as an
artist, it was fun to start drawing a different outfit on Spider-Man and doing different things and trying new looks and styles. And then, actually, one of the worst nightmares, though, was remember the clone cover where we had, like, 100 Spider-Men all on the cover?
God, right.
Yeah, so that was
a
nightmare.
That you allowed.
Yeah,
sometimes
exactly.
That's what you got to do.
Yeah, those writers keep, like, telling us to do these strange things, which we have to draw them out.
Yeah, but then you are just draw the big head in the foreground and a couple of hands in the background.
So, Todd, for you, what was the most exciting aspect of jumping on a story this big?
Can everybody hear us?
Yes.
Okay. I just want to make sure. I was miraculously hired to work on X-Factor, and I was on X-Factor for a little while in 94, and then I guess Tom DeFalco either got lazy or he got upset with his own dialogue. He said, you write younger dialogue. You're younger. You're a kid. You should come and do this. So I started dialoguing at your request. I don't know if you remember this. But
I don't. There's a lot, people keep telling me things that I didn't say that I have no memory of. I'll take your word for it.
You called me, and I went, oh, my God, it's Danny Finger up on the phone. And you invited me to come and help out Tom on doing dialogue. And so I was working on that, and then I got a phone call from Tom DeFalco and then Howard Mackey and
Mark DeMattis, and they said, listen, they're going to offer you the other Spider-Man book, the fourth Spider-Man book. Take it. We're about to do something really crazy. And it was the Spider-Clone Saga. And apparently, Terry had come up with this idea. Terry Cavanaugh had come up with the idea. And it was supposed to take 6 issues. Am I right?
It was supposed to be done pretty quickly.
Yeah. It was supposed to be that the clone showed up in town, snuck around. You didn't know who he was. He was going to go to Peter and Mary Jane and go, look, you guys have earned this now. Go off into the sunset, have a baby, go, the responsibility is now mine. And Peter was going to go, oh, thank God. You know, I've been doing this for 40 years.
And having MJ pregnant would sort of put the button on it.
Exactly.
There's no going back.
There's no, and so that was going to work. And as far as I know, in the way that I've been telling it, so it's the truth as far as I'm concerned, is that as soon as the clone showed up in the shadows and all of fandom started seeing this thing and going, what is that? The marketing guys came down to you editorial guys and said, oh, keep the clone. They love him. Is that the case?
Well, that's part of it. And by the way, you know, making up your version of stories, that will never get you anywhere.
No, right.
Because while that was going on in the Spider-Man office, in the comic industry in general, there was a collective nervous breakdown going on where sales had been at that peak from the boom. They were sliding. Everybody was freaking out. There was a corporate restructuring at Marvel Comics in the middle of the storyline. Reality shifted the way it does in, like, a comic book. And so all that was part of the madness going on. And as part of that, when marketing and sales saw how that contrary to everything else in the business, that Spider-Man sales were going up, they said, as marketing people will, keep doing it.
And another thing is, this is way before the internet, but the fan reaction, the mail we were getting was just insane as far as, like, and the readers. We were listening to the readers a lot.
And the pro reaction, even this was the amazing thing, where seasoned, cynical pros who've been writing comics, you know, for 20 years, they went, oh, my God, they're replacing Spider-Man. I can't let that be. And they were, right, they lost all, there were a few guys, some who were very good friends of mine, who lost all sense of professionalism and just suddenly became uber fans. And went, I mean, that's how powerful that was.
Yeah, and I managed to come back just in time to kill Ben Reilly.
that's what you do.
Now, when you guys were planning out the story initially, was the death of Aunt May something that was part of the original plan, or did that come into the story afterwards?
You know, I think that was part of the cleaning house thing.
Was that after you left?
We planned it. You know, it's, all these things came together. I think that was sort of, again, the part of the let's show them we're serious about changing things up, you know.
And Mark DeMattis just wanted to kill her. Everybody wants to kill Aunt May and be the person who said, but he did. It was a sweet, sweet issue.
It was really
beautiful.
I have that issue right here. I brought this home from my personal collection.
Luckily, given the nature of comics, you can kill people over and over. Right. You know, I'm going to come back anyway. So everybody gets their chance to kill Aunt May.
I do remember going to conventions and people saying, when is it going to end? What's going to happen? And we were not being allowed to finish it.
That was
after you left. Well, I know that under your wise direction, it would have not been the sprawling octopus that it became. I know that. And in my heart, I know that you would have gone to the wall for us and made that not crazy. But we were constantly saying, we were saying in meetings, please let us end this. Please let this go. And it went on for 2.5 years when it was supposed to be a month and a half worth of books.
Well, and I feel like in the legacy of it, at least initially, some of the amazing moments that happened during those initial stories were sort of washed away because people were so angry about the fact that it kept going and all this kind of stuff. But like this issue with the death of Aunt May, to me, is still one of my favorite Spider-Man issues of all time. I cried when I first read that issue. I mean, that the moment that she has with Peter where she tells him that she knew that he was Spider-Man, and then the moment where she passes, and that's on one of the slides up here, where you see Anna Watson and Mary Jane and Peter bawling their eyes out, and then Ben is outside, and he's going through the same, like, some of the most powerful images ever in comics for me, and as a Spider-Man fan, devastating. And so, you know, that was something where I felt like they did such a beautiful job with that issue that it was, it's something that, regardless of what happened later, I still cherish as one of the best issues of all time.
Yeah, J.M. and Mark Bagley, don't forget, you know, just brilliant.
Yeah. He's all right.
I can trust Spider-Man a little bit.
I do think that one of the things we were all trying to do the absolute best we could.
And we killed Doc Octopus.
I was
going to
say another moment, the death of Dr. Octopus. You know, the whole the pregnancy. Like, there was big moments in Spider-Man history that were happening in this event, for sure. Outside of just the clone, you know, there was big things happening in the life of Spider-Man. And. And obviously not all of them stuck as we went on, but as you go back and revisit some of these issues, I mean, there are some fantastic moments that still hold up very much to this day, and I'm sure that you're sort of proud of that legacy of those things you accomplished within it.
There's only one thing that I regret, and this, you know, there's one moment, and I think you guys probably know what I'm going to say. There's a moment, and I think it went through, like, 12 editors, 15 proofreaders. It was a moment where Peter slugs Mary Jane, and it was like, how, you know, it's when Peter's very angry and he's doing the testing on the blood and trying to figure out who's who, and Mary Jane tries to comfort him. And Sal, who I worship and love, drew it like a superhero scene. And so he, like, backhands her and she flies across the room. And it went through, I mean, maybe it just attest to, you know, some failing. But, I mean, really, a lot of people read it. It wasn't until it came out and readers went, Peter just slugged Mary Jane across the room, and went, oh, crap. That's, you
know. But was that part of, because at the time, when Ben comes back to town, Spider-Man was sort of going through this crisis, right, of his own, where he was losing himself. He was becoming darker, he was becoming angrier, so it seemed like there was a conscious decision to sort of write him, not necessarily unlikable, but getting away from the things that we loved about Peter Parker, which Ben Reilly would sort of have this enthusiasm and this sort of wonder when he comes back in.
And that's probably why all of us missed it, even, you know, and, you know, because it was the tone was right, but
right,
the level of violence of a guy with the proportionate strength of a spider hitting a normal woman, not such a great thing. But as I said, we went through a lot of ups and downs and crazy emotional crises, which is that's our job. You know,
sure.
To make Peter's life miserable, but then to make the high moments all the more wonderful.
And so I definitely want to open it up to questions, because I'm sure people have questions about this event. But as we sort of look to...
I think everybody here is looking for a place to eat their lunch. I don't know.
I don't know. I think we've got some good questions here. So as we sort of fast forward to now, the legacy of that event for a while was, oh, it was the worst thing ever and all this kind of stuff. And then one more day came along and sort of washed that away for everyone.
One more day addressed the same issue, though. You know, Park, which is...
Right?
Yeah.
Which if they had let it stick...
Goal.
They would never have to do that in the future.
Right, it was just the issue of, here's Peter, and this is, you know, it's a natural reaction. Anytime there's any kind of sales scare, it's, oh, we got away from our roots. Peter's no longer a teenager shooting pictures of the dead people living with MA. He's 25 years, you know, he's in his mid to late 20s, and he earns a good income, and he's married to a supermodel. You know, never mind that nobody said that in the years when the same situation was happening, but they were selling 5 million copies a month. But when things start to go downwards, that's the natural thing. We've gotten away
right.
from the roots of the character.
Right.
So one more day was the same
right.
kind of thing.
But I think that almost, like, unburdened fans to then look back on this event with more love for it. Because, you know, something else came along that sort of took away that, well, this is the thing I'm going to be really angry about with Spider-Man. And they were able to kind of look back on this event. And when you see the legacy of that event today, I mean, you just mentioned you just drew... Scarlet Spider. Scarlet Spider is out in the Marvel Universe now.
Absolutely.
Kane is still around, and people still clamor for Ben Reilly to come back. I mean, definitely now in comicdom, for the group that probably grew up reading this, there is a lot of love for that, and hopefully does that kind of feel more rewarding now that people are finally kind of really giving it the love?
I'm what I'm finding was we walked out of the Clone Saga when it was finally over and we could put it to bed, and we all looked at each other going, man, we just put the worst blight on the Spider-Man mythology. The Clone Saga will go down in history as the worst thing that ever happened to Spider-Man. But the kids who read that when they were 11 and 12 years old, when they got to be 25 and 26, were going, that was the greatest thing I ever read in my life. So there is, I have a friend, Mark Nathan, who runs the Baltimore Comic Con, has a theory that there's a 20 to 25 year loop.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That the things that you read when you're a kid, you will then want to see again when you get to a certain, so you can just, he keeps thinking my career is going to get better because of this. I don't know. I
hope
you
see it again because you have an adult, you have a different perspective.
Exactly, right. So when they collected the Clone Saga a couple years ago, I was amazed. I was like, why would you do that?
In color, every single
color. Sold it, and it sold like crazy.
Yeah, at the time I was actually working on Batman and Spider-Man at the same time, and I worked on Nightfall, The Breaking of Batman, and just a couple months ago, I did Batman versus Bane again, 20 years later, and I've been working on I worked on the newer Clone Saga, a couple of covers, which is also, again, 20 years later. It's literally a cycle of that. But the new version, they did the short version. They got it right. They kind of went back to our original intent of how it was supposed to be.
Well, I mean, it's been 20 years. This is the first time I've ever done a panel about it.
Literally.
And it sort of adds things to the tapestry of Spider-Man that we sort of look back upon today, and it keeps some of that. And I think you saw the same thing recently with the Superior Spider-Man run where, you know, you get characters like Anna Maria Marconi who are now part of Spider-Man's supporting cast, even though there's been sort of a soft reset to the status quo. And so no matter what you like or don't like about these particular events, the little pieces that they pick up and become part of Spider-Man's legacy is pretty awesome when you look back on that.
Well, that's what they do in the movies, you know. They pick and choose from all the different universes and mythologies and say, here's what's going to be the version that will be seen by 100 times more people than ever as a comic.
Right. And to me, though, it's cool that, you know, as creators, we're just, like, putting in new visuals or new characters or writing in new, and you never expect anything to stick. You know, it's like, okay, we got the deadline done, we're done with this story, and that's it. And then to have some, you know, only a very few, but certain things actually do resonate with the audience, and they're like, or again, like, somebody who's writing a character now that was reading this stuff 20 years ago was like, oh, I really like that character. I'm going to use them again.
Where did that come from?
Right. Their formative childhood.
So do we have folks in the audience who have questions? If you do, why don't you just come right over here. This mic, unfortunately, is wired, and it seems like our wireless one isn't working great. So if you just want to come over here, if you have a question, you can ask the panel. People just line up over here, and we'll go from there.
I remember the tail end of the Clone Saga. Mary Jane and Peter's daughter, Mary Jane either miscarried or she gave birth, or the baby died during the childbirth. Was there any consideration as to having the child survive and sort of explore Mary Jane and Peter as parent, as young parents, as well as him being a superhero?
You mean Spider-Girl?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. Yes, Spider-Girl.
Tom really ran with that, absolutely, made it his own baby, and she... I don't think anybody's allowed to write Spider-Girl other than Alan.
did that not start in a What If?
It did, because I have
that one at home where and that was a fantastic issue, and then people just reacted to that, and it sort of ran with it. So,
who would have thought that Tom DeFalco would be such a great channeler for teenage girls? You've seen or met Tom.
But Danny, I remember when we did that, though, we kind of purposely left it vague, like it could be open-ended.
I think I'd gone by then. I do remember that.
Okay. Like, what are we going to do?
Right.
Go ahead.
Oh. So, hey guys, I pretty much started reading comics, and the Clone Saga was one of the first major storylines that I read, so I can't believe it's been 20 years. It's shocking.
Yeah, right.
So you guys mentioned, it went over for 2 years, and it just kept expanding. Do you guys remember any ideas that were left on the cutting room, or something that you just would not do, like you would refuse for whatever reason?
Well, not so much that we wouldn't do, but I think the thing that would have been both nice creatively and fan-wise and profitable for the company would have been those Tales of the Lost Years of Spider-Man. There was one that J.M. and Peter Jr. and Klaus did that was, remember the time?
Yeah, it was.
But, I mean,
The Lost Years. That's what it was called.
The Lost Years. That was supposed to be a whole continuing series, a mini-series. That was one of the rich things about, if the real Spidey was in exile, what did he do? Well, here's yet another story you'll want to buy about what happened to him.
When you were saying before what was there, I think, or you had mentioned, I think that Mark's eyes glazed over when you said, we've got all these years that we could tell other stories. And Mark was like, I want that. I know that he did. I remember him saying that in a meeting. He was just like, those are mine. Nobody else can do those. I'm going to do those. He was just ready for that. So, it inspired. It was such an inspiring decision to go and do that, to be able to have those new things. It was just opening up a big Pandora's box of whatever we wanted to throw at it. Mr. T's outside.
No, we got a couple more minutes. Mr. T's, he's a pretty nice guy when you get to know him. Obviously, one of the big things that happened towards the end of that event was Norman Osborn coming back, and sort of there's that great reveal, and that's on the slide up here, too, where he rips his shirt open and you see the scar on his chest and everything else. Like, how far do you think that went to cementing him as, like, the Spider-Man villain? I mean, not that he wasn't already thought that way, but...
I was doing online comics at Byron Price at that point, so...
I was there.
Yep.
It was horrible. we would honestly, trying to get this thing to work, Howard and... We would have conference calls, and it would be 6 or 7 people on the conference call, and our ears, it would be for hours, and our ears would get warm, and you'd go, am I bleeding?
Whose idea was Norman? Was it
and,
Norman?
But Norman Osborn, I gotta say, to tell the story as quick as I can. We were in a meeting, and we were trying to figure out, and everybody was throwing ideas of how the Clone Saga should end, and what should go on, and you had asked just before, where'd you go? You had asked, was there anything left on the cutting room floor? There was a lot left on the cutting room floor in the last 6 months because we all had ideas and we all believed in them. We were like, this will work because of this. And Tom Brevoort and Mark Bernardo were two of the editors that were there at the time. They loved my ideas so much they were going to, make me the Pope or something. Those guys loved that one. The one that Tom DeFalco had was another good one. And then we had this big meeting and who should be in town but Stan Lee. And Stan came, and he said, the only books that I still read are the Spider-Man books. I can't keep track of everything else. And before that, Tom had turned to me and said, listen, when you meet Stan for the first time, I want to remind you, he doesn't remember people's names very much. I was the editor-in-chief for 8 years, and he still calls me Tony. So we went in this meeting. I'm sitting next to Stan through the whole meeting going, oh, my God, it's Stan Lee. And he said, if you're going to do something, you've got to go big. If you're going to end this... it's got to be the Green Goblin. It's either got to be Green Goblin or Dr. Octopus. And we had already played with Doc Ock. Norman was out of the picture. Bring him back. So Stan really was the one who said, we had already talked about the Green Goblin and doing it, but Stan was the one who said, you got to do that. And we all went out going, God said.
And
aside, I will say this. We were all in this meeting, and Stan was next to me, and... Bob Harris at the time was the editor-in-chief now, and he said, Stan, what's your favorite of all the books? And he said, what one I like? The one where they were just in the Savage Land. And that was my book. And I sat up, and the other three writers looked at me like they were going to kill me. And Bob said, that was Todd's book. And Stan turned to me and goes, good job, Tony.
I remind me that I was the one, because I was still running the line then, who had to call Stan and tell him we were killing Aunt May.
How did that go?
Stan is a professional. It's like, I think all of us here are much more emotionally connected to Aunt May being around and very, he co-created her, so in a way he's less connected. He doesn't have that fanish connection that we all have.
And so if Ben Reilly, if that had played out the way that you originally intended, you mentioned there's a lot of stuff on the cutting room floor. You mentioned the lost years of Spider-Man. Are there stories that you really, really would have liked to have done with that character, and any that sort of jumped to mind as this is what I really wanted to do?
I'll tell you, because nobody's ever said it before, but because the Clone Saga came from something back in 1975 or 74.
Which I read when I was a kid.
Right, me too. So I went to one of my favorite stories from back then, and my suggestion was that you had Peter and Ben, who were the clone and the real one, whichever, and Marvel definitely wanted nothing more than to end this and close this all up in a nice little bow. I wanted to go and have a third Spider-Man come in from Doctor Doom's time platform from a Marvel team-up and come and say, "Holy crap, Ben, you're not supposed to be here. Come with me. I'll get you where you gotta go." And it's all over. They just disappear into the whole thing. And that's the one that Mark DeMattis and Tom Brevoort were like, "It's perfect. It wraps everything up and it goes back to something else to finish it all up." So we championed that for about 3 months, and finally somebody turned to me and went, "No, we're not doing your idea, Todd." And that was the end of it.
They do Doctor Who all the time.
Do they do that all the time? Doctor Who shows up?
I don't watch a lot of Doctor Who, I'm sorry.
I'm hurting anybody's feelings. I'm a completist, and someone said it started in the 60s. I don't have that kind of time.
Yeah, there's a lot of work.
Spider-Man story.
Yeah, that's right. That's true.
Was there a story for you, Danny, that you wanted to...
Not so much. No, I said the lost years, and I mean, I think the story that I wanted to tell, which was another one that was controversial to say the least, was even before the Clone Saga, was bringing back, you know, or pretending to bring back Peter's parents.
Uh-huh.
That's another panel.
Well, what's interesting about that is certainly with, like, Amazing Spider-Man 2 and what we've seen of the new sort of story of Peter's parents, I think that... that is something people are curious about. You know, that is something that they'd like to see sort of explored more.
Well, I just, you know, again, I thought it would be something that would just really screw with Peter's head. It's like, all his life, his identity is, I'm an orphan, my parents are dead, I'm the band is dead, it's my fault. Yeah. And then suddenly, oh, hi, Peter. You know, we're home, we went out to get the quarter milk. We got a little
right.
Now we're back, you know. So I just thought that was something that no one had... You know, I think because the whole thing where he's like, it was so... essential that he was the regular guy, superhero, but there was that annual in 1968 that established his parents were agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and, you know, or CIA agents, which, but, you know, so he was no longer the orphan with the Joe average parents. And so they've run with that now, and now his parents are super scientists and all that stuff.
Well, as we kind of wrap up here, any sort of final thoughts? As you look back on the Clone Saga, you see some of the covers here today. We talked about some of the moments there. As far as takeaways, if someone's, you know, revisiting that stuff today, is there something that you hope that they take away from that? What's sort of something that you hope that they walk away with in terms of...
The line that just becomes, you know, two lines, you know, I mean, they're sort of related. One is the famous Robert Crumb line, "It's just lines on paper, folks." And again, Tom DeFalco is the source of much wisdom and insight, and he, you know, and we were doing this whole story, although the writers, you know, had to believe it was permanent. Tom and I each had sort of our own different backdoors out of it, but at one point, Tom just said, "Yeah, the guys after us are going to change it all back anyway."
It's true.
So, I mean, I think...
Who could have figured,
They're comics, we love that you get excited about them, but, you know, if ultimately there's enough feeling that we get feedback from fans, we can alter the way we're going.
One of the cool things for me about that particular time period, especially in comics, was that it was probably more collaborative as far as, you know, all four books were tied in directly together, all the writers were working directly together, all the artists were, you know, continuing stories from one issue to the other. So all that stuff happening, though, unfortunately Clone Saga had a lot of higher ups messing that up, but it was still cool to be that, you know, I think graphic novels kind of destroyed that in a sense, that they're now, well, it's not as I don't know. Back then, you know, the books literally from month to month, it would be the same story exact. Right. Now everything's like collected into, oh, 6 issues of this book is one story. 6 issues of this book is another story. They're not connected anymore in the same way.
Oh, yeah, that's another panel of the evolution. Right? Right. The evolution of the certain craft element of comics. Right. But,
yeah, and I would also say that in going back and sort of researching for this panel, the one thing that jumped out at me is that you used to be able to, you can look at these covers and see the entire Clone Saga. You can look at the covers from the very first issues all the way to the end, and you can see the Clone Saga play out. And when you pick up comic books today, most often you're seeing a cover image that has nothing to do with what's happening on the inside of the book. And these were the days where I can flip through the long box and actually read the story through the covers, and that's kind of amazing, and you can see some of these great moments.
Well, for me. Also, the artist who did the interiors usually did the covers.
Absolutely so right, yeah.
I guess there's something about a story like that that as much as it pressed buttons, you know, for fans, also, at its best, brought out the best creators. I think the writers and artists did some of the best work of their career, because it seemed like there was so much, and there was so much at stake. Yeah.
And for anybody that has not read that recently, if you could track down the collected editions, I'm sure they're on like the Marvel Unlimited app and things like that. There are some amazing moments in that that are definitely worth revisiting. So thanks to Danny Fingeroth, thanks to Todd Zago, thanks to Scott Hanna. You guys have been fantastic, and thanks to everybody for coming. Thank you.